How are you feeling coming back to the family home?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I used to feel very strange. Frankly, I used to avoid it. I didn't really know how to feel. So I just used to steer clear. But now, I'm intrigued. I sort of embrace it. It all feels strange.
I am a log fire and burn best undisturbed. Do not poke me.
There was a sort of self-destructive thing going on. Very complex man.
Night. The recruiting centre for the inexhaustible army of shadows that make war on us.
He really thought he ought to be able to have you if he wanted you.
I have always revelled in impersonal violence.
Something frightened him.
I succumb from time to time to the comforting theory of the last laugh. More than any other in my life, I have been the prisoner of two events. Striking a pregnant Joan, and that moment in Iraq.
I think there might have been an accident.
Hello, I'm Saul Wordsworth, author, musician, journalist, and son of former Fleet Street journalist Christopher Wordsworth, whose diaries are the subject of this podcast series. In the previous episode, my father had been living in a disused cottage in the Midnight Hills, 7 miles from civilization. Whilst up here, he was alerted to an appeal in the Observer for essays from those living beyond the margins. The collection, Underdogs, was published in 1961. My father's much-heralded contribution had led to a small trickle of book reviews. But following a short-lived marriage to local woman Margaret Ahern, he was back on the Midnight.
I have not moved an inch in the last 15 years, jammed in this crevasse, longing. I have got older, wiser, a sense of balance which, if I had had it 15 years ago, would have kept me out of the crevasse.
He wouldn't remain in the crevasse for long. It's now 1962, the year of the Beatles' first single, launch of groundbreaking satirical show That Was the Week That Was, and the Cuban Missile Crisis, a seismic world event whose resolution was in a small part down to the peacemaking efforts of his nemesis across the valley, Bertrand Russell. Also in the valley at this time was a BBC director named Dennis Mitchell, who had arrived to make a television documentary about the area. Somehow, it's not clear how, my dad knew Mitchell and was promptly hired as a liaison officer for the project. He left behind the solitude of the Midnight Hills and moved into the Goat Hotel in nearby Bethgelert with the BBC crew and remained there for the month of filming, running errands, making sandwiches. He made excellent sandwiches. And generally, liaising.
I do, in fact, blame people like the BBC for not seeking me out and employing me years ago.
The film, The Changing Village, was shown on the BBC on April the 18th, 1962. My father cited in the credits as a research. I wondered if he'd had a brief cameo, but no recording survives, nor even a copy of the script. By the middle of 62, my father's reviewing work had matured from a trickle to a steady stream and was being augmented by occasional sports reporting. This meant leaving the depths of Snowdonia late Friday or first thing on Saturday, finding his way to Edgbaston, Gloucester, Lords or Moseley, before returning that night, then rolling down the hill for his weekly Sunday lunch at John Jones's, furious that his piece hadn't appeared in the Observer.
Fucking arseholes!
And only later learning about regional variations. With a career taking shape and London calling, my father, now 48, was slowly, but inexorably, edging towards the exit.
Beginning to use Himalayan words again, to hark back more and more. Am I in the process of pulling out from another community?
There was, though, still time for one final indiscretion. There was always time for one of those. After the failure of his marriage to Margaret, my father turned his attentions to another woman, Cherry, who happened to be visiting the area. The two of them embarked upon a brief affair, after which she returned to London and told her husband, an antique dealer. As his friend Ivor described to me back in 2007, the man drove up from London to the Croyser Valley, armed with a loaded pistol, and let it be known that he was looking for my dad, and he planned to kill him. He eventually tracked him down. And they ended up having a convivial pint together at the Brondano Arms.
Christopher Wordsworth is the most noticeable person in the Brondano Arms. I think he does this himself in order to hide a less obvious self.
This is the voice of John O'Connor, son of Philip O'Connor, reading from his father's book, Living in Croyser, published in 1962. Philip O'Connor had become well known for his memoir, A Very Public Baby, and he and my father became firm friends during this period. To me, the observations are astute, the sketch of my dad instantly recognisable.
He is one of those people whose bright and witty public personalities disguise a love-seeking, homely plainness. He is oblique in communication, finding it difficult to stand still for too long in the eye of any beholder. But his wit is excellent, a most undefeated man, though he flirts with defeat. A connoisseur of life, he knows the titbit by the wayside tastes better than the presented banquet. His failing? Too great a dedication to his personal drama. His achievement? Wit. The spirit laughing at what the heart has lost. The eyes are fairly inscrutable, something of the ram's glazed immunity to the perception of others that so characterized the face of his ancestor, William Wordsworth. He may one day write a remarkable book.
The book would never be written, though O'Connor was right on many counts. My father's inability to stay still, related perhaps to his shyness or the concealment of his true self. An invincible wit, that inscrutable, unreadable face, and his homely, love-seeking plainness. Because whatever he had done in the past, and however much his desires and intentions had become twisted or diverted, all I ever felt he was reaching for was love.
Familiarity breeds content.
Ideally, with a little financial support thrown in.
What I need is the affluence of a good woman.
There was no leaving party, no grand soiree. Instead, in January 1963, nearly 10 years after his arrival, my father gathered his belongings, fishing rod and waders, small knapsack of clothes, the diaries, and caught a train to London, then a taxi to Woodlands Road, Barnes, where Cyril Cobbett, a friend of John Jones, was living with his family. Cyril rented my dad the upstairs flat. In the middle flat was a woman named Dorothy Fletcher, who had two young children and was living with an actor who at the time was appearing as one of Robin Hood's Merry Men in a BBC adaptation. He wasn't merry for long. Here's Ivor Nottingham, who has appeared in previous episodes.
Chris and she met, fell in love. And the actor was moved out, and Chris moved in. And I happened to know, because I was in London at the time, and I helped Chris move a lot of the actors' gear out of the office flat into the shed in the back of Cyril's house.
This is not the end of the story, but it is the end of the diaries. I say end. It turned out, unbeknownst to me, that one of the five hardback books I handed over to Emma the transcriber was actually from 1967. But there were very few entries contained within, and what there was more fragmented than usual, less considered and less refined.
Tunnel vision, and you know what the tunnel is.
And with no real narrative. Of course, it's possible that other diaries were written and lost, though somehow I doubt it. Those I inherited were bound and preserved, as if for posterity. Save for his fishing rod, my dad held little store by things, but the diaries were a part of him. He knew their pages held some exceptional writing, not least the documenting of his extraordinary time with Sue Russell, and possible source material for a novel, the one that would rescue him, whatever his circumstances may be at the time. But even if he'd wanted to, he was quickly overtaken by events, in particular the effort to establish himself as a reliable and effective freelancer on Fleet Street. With his track record for spending, he continued to struggle to keep his head above water, but he had learned some hard lessons along the way, and perhaps for the first time in his life, he found something that he felt was commensurate with and worthy of his skills. Here's Eleanor Brooks, a presence throughout the series.
I think that it was an absolute blessing that he found someone where he could use his a genius for the neat phrase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
My father had a lifetime to prepare for his new role, and his gift for phrase making, allied to half a century of reading like an incineration, made him more than equal to the task. He quickly found himself to be a fixture on Fleet Street. His wit and encyclopedic knowledge, an asset on the literary desk, as well as the sports pages. Clifford Makins, his sports editor on The Observer, and about whom he would coin the phrase, a legend in his own lunchtime, warmly embraced him as an addition to his stable of gifted writers. Terry Kilmartin became his longtime literary editor at The Observer, Bill Webb, his equivalent at The Guardian. Each came to rely on my dad's work, and though he was older than all of them, they would each retire in turn, while he remained, toiling away for the next incumbent. This was Fleet Street's heyday, an era of long lunches, big characters, and bigger expense accounts, all of which played to my father's strengths. Always a convivial pub-goer, his bon mots fitted right in the back room at Elvino's, the nearest thing Fleet Street had to a literary salon, where he would pass the afternoons and sometimes the late mornings, rubbing shoulders with the greats of the day, from sports writing legend Hugh McIlvenny and political columnist Alan Watkins, to the Observer's TV critic Clive James and future independent editor Simon Kellner. Today's Elvinos boast a very different clientele, mostly barristers from the nearby law courts, though it retains a certain charm.
It's in Fleet Street, and the newspapers then were in Fleet Street.
It was there that I met Peter Crookston, one of my dad's former Observer colleagues.
I used to come here with Alan Watkins quite a lot, yeah.
And I think you were going to introduce me. You said, I've got someone that I'd like you to meet. Oh, yes. Knew your father really well.
He didn't turn up or something?
No. He died the week before.
Oh, God, no.
I will come back to my father's career in the final episode. Briefly, though, let's hear from Miriam Gross, former colleague and the godmother I mentioned at the start of episode one, who I wasn't allowed to see and with whom he had a terrific falling out.
There was a sort of self-destructive thing going on. Yeah. He's a very complex man. I always felt for him, you know. I never resented his resentment to me, but I didn't like it terribly. But, you know, and it didn't make me not like him. He was a very, very interesting and generous man. And indeed, I introduced him to Tamara, who I thought he would like, and I thought she would like him. And then this worked terribly well. And they lived happily ever after.
I'm not sure about that. But it is true that in 1968, my dad was introduced to Tamara Salomon, at the time a fellow reviewer. They hit it off immediately, but my dad was still in a relationship with Dorothy. I need to sort some things out, he said. I'll be in touch in a couple of months. True to his word, a few weeks later, he was back. Which brings us neatly onto my mum, and the one relationship in his life that would endure. My mum was, like him, a great reader. Like him, she brimmed with wit. Like him, she would often talk about writing a book, a cookbook in her case, specifically a dessert cookbook, even more specifically, a jelly cookbook. Only in the same breath to talk herself out of it, complaining that she'd have to write about what she called all those horrible meat jellies. Because unlike Dad, my mum was not one for rich food, heavy drinking, or any kind of high living. She was a bright, sensible, Jewish lefty, occasionally standoffish, anxious yet tough in her way, even-tempered, musically gifted, and 20 years his junior. She was also lovely. She was my mum. They married in 1970, and he moved into her rented Bloomsbury flat on Old Gloucester Street, a 15-minute walk from Fleet Street. Though I imagine Dad always caught a cab. Then expensed it. In 1972, 2 years into their marriage, when she was 37 and he 57, she fell pregnant. This prompted a crisis. My father already had 4 children and maintained that he was too old, didn't want the responsibility, the financial drain, the pram in the hall stymieing his creative potential. He declared that unless she solved the problem, he would leave. My mother sought out the wisdom of her Aunt Esther, her Russian mother's sister. "Tamara, if you want this child, you must have it," Esther told my mum. "Christopher may leave, but I imagine he will not." He didn't. A few months later, I arrived. In 1975, my parents moved to Harpenden, Hertfordshire, lured there by the proximity of my mother's parents. Oh yeah, I went with them.
We are approaching the bridge under what we as locals would call the Nicky Line.
Yeah.
We once received a postcard from a friend of my mother's that said, to the Wordsworths, second on the left under the bridge, Harpenden. We got it. Here's the bridge. But I'm going to take us up the first left, Paul.
Okay.
And then we can come down Park Mount, and then we can park just shy of 20 Park Mount and then approach them stealthily from above.
Okay.
That's the house that belonged to... He burned the house down when he was about 16.
Well, it looks... Yes, it looks relatively...
It was rebuilt, yeah. I haven't been down here for I don't know how long. A long time. Okay. I really thought about how to introduce myself to these people who may have already received the letter and just ignored it. But I don't know. I'll just say what feels right if they open the door.
Okay. And where...
It's just a couple of doors down from here. On the bend. Appropriately enough, round the bend, Paul. I guess we don't want to freak them out too much either. I don't mean because of your beard, but because you're wearing headphones and wielding a mic.
I can take the headphones off.
We used to have a blue door.
It's quite a new door, isn't it?
Yeah. Maybe someone kicked it in. You know how rough happening to people.
Actually, I don't know how rough Harpenden could be, but I don't think it's that rough.
It was certainly a bit rougher when I grew up around here, especially being on the Luton side. I used to say that to girls for street cred, that I lived on the Luton side of Harpenden.
Because it's beyond the bridge, the Nicky Line Bridge.
There you go, yeah. We're the wrong side of the tracks, literally. Nah, I mean, Harpenden is not a rough place, and it certainly isn't now. I mean, this is prime commuter belt territory. Very expensive properties. I don't think there's anyone in, is there? And also because there's no one parked outside.
Despite writing ahead to the current occupants, I tried our old telephone number, but it didn't work. Paul and I found ourselves stood outside rather than inside a property. Not for the first time in this podcast series. Not that it really mattered. It was enough to be here, to drink in the memories, good and bad.
Well, or just describe it.
It's a semi-detached house with a garden on a suburban, fairly busy street. We're on a hill on the bend. I think it was it three or four bedrooms, so it's a good size. None of the bedrooms were particularly big, but one of them we counted as my dad's study. At the back, which held all the secrets, the diaries, strange medicaments, books about sex that I used to occasionally reference in my teen years.
When I was in my early teens, I entered my dad's study on the hunt for cricket magazines. Instead, I happened upon a notebook, mostly empty, but with jottings at the front and back. Perfect, I thought. A rough book. Promptly tore out the soiled pages and put it in my school bag. When I mentioned this to my mum, she looked horrified.
Oh God, Saul, what have you done?
What had I done?
Whatever you do, don't let your father know.
Nothing was ever said, mentioned, brought up. I guess he didn't notice, because he wasn't writing.
Yeah. Played a lot of cricket down this alley, but it did mean that you had to play pretty straight. Couldn't really veer too much to the off or leg side.
Do you mean this alley?
Yeah, this alleyway.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and probably meant that I ended up playing straight to balls that were either outside off or a leg, and that's why I'm standing here and not playing, representing England, or didn't represent England in my 20s.
That's the only reason, is it?
That's the only reason, Paul, yeah.
Recollections of Harpenden bring me onto my own diaries and my first entry, penned back in 1988, age 15. Yes, here it is. Saul Wordsworth was born on December the 14th, 1972, and it was obvious from the start that he was a fucking genius. You'll have to forgive my bumptious 15-year-old self. He's clearly being tongue-in-cheek. Well, I hope he is. But regardless, it does display a certain belief in his, my, abilities, and, perhaps unlike my father, a confidence and determination that, despite completely losing my way, even my mind, over the next 20 years, would help push me to go one further than my dad and become a published novelist. From the moment I arrived, it would be fair to say that my dad was obsessed with me. I was, until his death, his sole focus, complete with the regular refrain, "I live through you, Saul." When I couldn't avoid it, I was cosseted, indulged, protected and spoiled. At Christmas, expensive gifts would be proffered and, when not adored, met with fury. Make no mistake, unlike my half-siblings, mine was a childhood of opportunity. I was surrounded by learning and books. We had enough money. I received piano lessons. Having belatedly learned his own monetary lessons, Dad's only real extravagance was food. I was certainly the only kid who took his rugby boots to school in Fortnum and Mason bags. But from an early age, I could see that he was nothing like the other dads. Sure, he was older, often better educated, always shorter, and he worked from home. But he seemed troubled, restive, and his temper, these outbursts, were so utterly disproportionate to their trigger. Often, I couldn't even see a link. I was the original banister boy, leaning up against them day after day, praying for the latest episode to subside, before eventually bolting into the room and pleading for the row to stop. Growing up, we had a photograph of my dad, aged about 2, on our mantelpiece. He looks expectant, innocent, helpless. At his worst, my mum would fetch it down and we'd stare at it together. "Pathetic," she'd say, and we'd both laugh. And yet, despite his behaviour, he knew what a child needed. He said as much in his diaries.
It is better for a child to feel confined, misunderstood, even crushed against a background of continual certainty and permanence, than to be the beloved treasure of an anxious, unstable environment.
Clearly, he is referring to his own childhood, in particular his mother, who, he claimed,
"flogged my soul to plasticity with cotton wool and gouged out my spirit's eyes with the marshmallow talons of indulgent love."
Because what do we do? Almost all of us, but take the same paths and repeat the same mistakes our parents take and make. By his own admission, the public school system hadn't worked for him, yet he would regularly talk about sending me away to boarding school. I'm not sure that they could have afforded it, and I certainly didn't want to go. Eventually, to save face, Dad settled on, "I think Mum would miss you too much." I could tell he meant he would.
"I possess excellent qualities, such as pride, generosity and devotion, but I am not quite a real person."
I always assumed that everyone had seen or experienced my dad's anger, that it was regularly unleashed upon friends and colleagues. One of the biggest surprises for me during this process has been the discovery that this wasn't the case at all. Here's Eleanor Brooks.
"He didn't show his temper. It was sarcasm mostly when he was with us. If he had a bad temper, that might explain it, because I never saw his bad temper."
Really?
"He probably guarded against losing his temper with us."
And former colleague, poet and author of an acclaimed memoir about his own father, Blake Morrison.
"Yes, he was shy. And that's why I say, I don't ever remember any difficulty, because the idea of him you talked about, you know, that there was a bit of a temper at home or so on. I don't remember any exhibitions or difficulties of that kind. It was just this sense that he probably lived a pretty interesting life and had some pretty good ideas and high ambitions, and this really wasn't the fulfilment of them.
But here is broadcaster Mavis Nicholson, who certainly witnessed it on numerous occasions.
It was excessive, wasn't it? When it was bad, it was so excessive, but over something so small. He seemed to suddenly take a delight in losing his temper and getting his own way, really.
And here, too, is my half-brother David Wordsworth, who certainly saw it too, though I think as the exception and not the norm, and so recalls a specific event that apparently he often recounts to his wife, Anne.
What was the negative for you?
How long is this section going to be? his tantrums. And I used to contribute money to my holidays, fishing holidays, and I didn't mind that. I didn't expect it to, but my money was always dependent on a salary, which was always dependent on a calendar date. And there was one day when I couldn't. It hadn't gone into the Abbey in Oswestry. And I went and said, sorry, I can't get any out. And he jumped up down the pavement like Yosemite Mike or Sam, whatever that character was, in a fuming rage because I couldn't give him money. And I went back in and had to plead a case for him to give me some money because they could see like it was a regular payment. So, yes, that's a memory.
So why did he show his temper only with us? Well, as my mother always liked to say, home is the place where we behave the worst and are treated the best. But my best guess is frustration. I'm sure that when he began working on Fleet Street, he felt a thrill seeing his name in print, a frisson, but that this quickly settled into the norm, the everyday, and it left him unfulfilled, that he wasn't leaving a true literary mark. And once I'd been born, he was locked in. Sure, he could abandon another wife, another child, go off and try to write, have his freedom. But this time he had skin in the game, his investment in my future. And that meant sticking around and earning enough to support us. This is Professor Ray Monk from Episode 3, and who met my dad in the early 90s.
I didn't know about the novel. I only found out about that when you published your piece in The Guardian. I thought of him as a book reviewer, essentially. I mean, he was doing a lot of book reviewing at that time. And he talked quite openly about his finances and how he wasn't really getting enough commissions to keep the wolf from the door financially. And he expressed a bit of bitterness towards various literary editors who used to commission book reviews from him and no longer did. So that aspect came across, that he was enormously likable, he was great fun. But even though I didn't know about the novel, I could certainly discern a strong element of sadness and disappointment. And although I didn't know about the novel, there was also there, and it was clear, you know, in almost everything he said, a sense of unfulfilled ambition.
I'm also sure that much of this frustration was with himself, that he recognised his potential, but that this hadn't married up with his achievements. And as a coping mechanism, he fashioned a kind of alternative reality, one where the great novel actually existed and would come to pass, in an attempt to deny what he called the grisly failure. He certainly had at times an oblique relationship to the truth and to reality. Here's my half-brother David Wordsworth again, who recalls two stories.
A crite, which is a snake that jumps and spits at you, is very venomous, was in the bath about to strike me when he killed it with, I can't remember which particular golf club, and he slew the beast. And then on my third or fourth birthday, a great eagle swooped down and carried my cake across the jungle. I think this may have been based on an adaptation of Greek mythology, but I don't think he was entirely truthful about how his early poetic talents were appreciated by C.S. Lewis and stuff like that. And he nearly won the Newdigate Prize and so on. I don't know about that.
Yeah, he was a great fabricator of his own life.
No, he was, yes. He was a bit of a mitty. Yes, he was.
Bit of a mitty. What a pity.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
So what's it like growing up with an older father? A few brief highlights. TV so loud you could hear it across the street. Anticipating the trip over the telephone cord, the mishearing of conversations, the technical hiccups, and stepping in where necessary to prevent accident or confusion. A fear he'd collapse in the street, especially on day trips to London, especially after his heart attack. On my first day at senior school, the games teacher recounted a conversation he'd had on a train back from Twickenham with my grandfather about my coming to St George's. "But sir," I said, "my grandfather isn't a rugby man." It took a full 10 minutes, stood there in front of the other boys, before the penny dropped. "Oh, sir, you mean my father?" Himself a fine sportsman, Dad was emotionally entangled in my own sporting life. His nephew, Alan Wordsworth, son of his brother Victor, had represented England at rugby. I showed early promise, but a broken leg cut short my rugby career. Though after being kept home for nearly a month after the accident, the school was forced to call to ask if I was ever coming back. My dad, in full overprotective mode, answered,
"But what if he got knocked over in the corridor?"
I would miss a lot of school. I was an extremely anxious child, and I could convince my parents, always happy to have me around, that I needed to stay home. Not that home was always an easy place to be. The greatest source of misery between us, and the true battleground of our relationship, was, somewhat ironically, literature. From an early age, I was a voracious reader, happy with my books and comics, until Dad stepped in. How about The Eagle instead of The Beano? Conan Doyle over Enid Blyton? This battle, his efforts to change my natural course and force me down his own path, went on relentlessly until eventually I simply ground to a halt and stopped reading. Yet he would continue to buy me books, and we would sit together and I would try and read them, and I'd fall asleep, a mixture of misery, resentment and boredom. As a result, and for as long as I can remember, I would fill the airwaves with whatever came to mind in an attempt to avoid the eruption. It was exhausting constantly keeping him at bay, and I would dread the occasions when I knew we'd be alone together. But every so often, despite my best efforts, his frustration would rise to the surface and...
Why do you think I keep all these fucking books?
Something similar happened in his attempts to get me interested in fly fishing. He bought me a rod, which I ended up treading on and breaking on the riverbank, while resentfully skimming stones.
Fucking assholes!
It was never a case of letting me find my own way. He was there, he said, to ensure I didn't make any of the same mistakes he did, and to lessen my burden, which often meant adding to it. Whenever I had chores to be done, to clean my rugby boots, whiten my cricket pads, prepare my packed lunch, despite my constant protestations, I'd come downstairs in the morning to find the pads whitened, the lunch made. First world problems for sure, but it still drove me mad. Whether any of this is related is hard to say, but from an early age, I couldn't imagine growing up or living as an adult. I simply couldn't picture it. I didn't want to have to face such responsibilities. Intuitively, I knew that on some fundamental level, it wasn't in me, and as I'll explore, when it came to it, I was kind of proven right. We interrupt this episode to bring you a pod flash.
Middle class, middle-aged white man complains about father in podcast shocker.
As difficult childhoods go, mine probably registers a 4, a 5 at best. But hey, who's counting? Besides, this isn't a misery memoir. Far from it. The challenge here is to talk without either blame or self-pity, because neither is present. There is no blame, no rancour. Nor do I sit in judgment on my father. Let he without sin cast the first fishing line. But I do want to remember and recreate, for you the listener, how things felt at the time, and how, as adulthood approached, events seemed to get away from me. Because it's the truth, and because maybe, just maybe, it might help someone. Today, such stories are part of the conversation, but back then, for me at least, airing such matters felt beyond the possible. It's for this very reason that I want to do it here, because it is, or was, so difficult for me to talk about. Also, if I was listening to this podcast, I'd want to hear about the child of this difficult but brilliant man. Find out what happened to him as he grew up, how smooth or rocky his ride, learn how he turned out. That's what completes the circle. And although aged 19, an experience, a moment in time, would shape my life for many years to come, I would not wish to be anywhere other than where I am today, happy with who I am and where I'm at. And for that, I have my parents, not least my dad, to thank. But here goes.
If you ever want another child, co-opt me. He'll be bright and good at games, and he'll bring little happiness, least of all to himself. I'll try to contribute to his upbringing.
I was a sound, if unspectacular, student. Creative, but not especially academic. When a select band of schoolmates was chosen to try for Oxbridge, I wasn't included. Then, suddenly, I was. A phone call from my mum, likely at the behest of my dad. Both were recipients of Oxbridge scholarships. And so it was that on the occasion of my 18th birthday, I found myself in the study of a Cambridge don, me making bad jokes about Martin Luther, and feeling very much not myself, a distant awareness that something was sliding, slipping. something I couldn't put into words, new and uncomfortable feelings. I couldn't visualize myself here, or, frankly, anywhere, in an adult world.
I was somehow enabled to cross into adulthood with my adolescent gear intact.
The one area where I was keen to grow up, this I had in common with my dad, was girls. At junior school, I would constantly pester my mum to ask the mothers of countless Susans, Sarahs and Emmas if they could come round for tea. Aged 15, I declare in my own diaries that the five most important things in the world are cricket, sex, comedy, friends and music, and not necessarily in that order. On the threshold of adulthood, however, my first sexual experience was somewhat disastrous. I should have used my dad's line.
Sorry if I seem nervous, but I've just had some terrible news from India.
Decidedly average A-level results were met with a fuck-off from Dad. I secured a place at a red brick university, but it was clear this was regarded as a failure. Also, I was taking a year out first. Why? Because I was rigid with fear at the prospect of going, though it felt that not going was not an option. I was unable to voice this anxiety, and none of my friends seemed unduly nervous. In fact, many of them had grand ambitions, careers planned out. Me? I had a blank, only the impossibility of the next step, which felt like a brick wall. When people asked what I was going to do in my year out, I told them that I'd be taking a very long bath. They'd laugh and I'd change the subject. Shades of my father. During that year, and with almost everyone away at university, I experienced a deepening sense of estrangement.
All the disasters occurred at a time of loneliness, isolation. I have a feeling in my water.
I took on local menial work, broke up with my girlfriend, visited relatives in Israel, played some cricket, badly. When at home with Dad, I would experience palpitations, a feeling that something was seeping into me, even something of him. I threatened to move out, to establish my own identity, but I didn't, couldn't upset my parents. Looking back, I wished I had. I couldn't concentrate, couldn't talk about it, whatever it was, and was daily now experiencing new and frightening sensations and emotions. All I felt I could do was count down the days till I would be departing for university. The impossibility of it still felt absolute, but I assumed it would happen. Like everything difficult in life, you find yourself somehow on the other side of the experience, and intact, wondering what all the worry had been about. And yet, the feelings were intensifying. The day before I was to go up to university, instead of packing, I spent the afternoon playing my guitar. That evening, I went to the pub, and in a further attempt to delay the inevitable, invited some friends back. As we sat in the sitting room of our Harpenden home, me by the window, them in chairs before me, I knew something was terribly wrong, experienced a terrifying and rising sense of impending disaster. And then it started. It began in my toes, like a tingling, quickly made its way up to my chest, before reaching my head, where a bomb went off in my brain.
That is the window seat that I was sat in when I suffered this terrific panic attack, and really that was the onset of
a breakdown that lasted for many, many years for me, actually. And it happened just there. Everyone's experience of breakdown is unique, uniquely powerful, and uniquely upsetting and bewildering to them. For me, sat in that chair, my life changed forever, and I knew this as it happened. Just like that, a switch had been flicked, and I had entered a different, altered state of being. My thoughts were no longer my own, but would leap around wildly and terrifyingly. There were two main thoughts, which I knew, or thought I knew, to be unassailably true. One, that there was no coming back from this. I was now stuck forever in this state. And two, that I couldn't tell anyone. The shame of it, the weakness, my perception of weakness, was too great.
And above it?
Above it is my parents' bedroom, in fact. That's where I went straight after I'd ushered everyone out the door. I went straight upstairs, and I knew instinctively that I had experienced a panic attack. A pretty profound panic attack that had, you know, been 19 years in the making. And my mum said, I'll give you a Valium. And so she gave me half a Valium when I went to bed. I don't think they probably knew what to do. Anyway, shall we see if we can go around? Let's just see.
I had two options. Not to go to university. Then what? Stay at home. Or go. I went, driving my parents up the following morning in our car, feeling not that my life was just beginning, but that it was, in fact, at an end.
Age of anxiety. Even the finger of fate has its hand bitten to the quick.
It would take me nearly two decades to unravel that night, to come to terms with what happened, start talking to those closest to me, and to refind myself.
Something that I had, that I have lost. A collar stud that has rolled between the floorboards of my mind.
For much of that period, I did feel broken. Fundamentally broken. Broken in a way that whatever might have been happening to me or around me was rendered pointless and meaningless by the internal experience. In effect, I had two lives, inside and out. In a stab at self-protection, I did my best to ensure that the external self bore no relation to the internal, bolstered by a wall of wit and, when available, alcohol, the only means by which I could feel anything approaching my old self.
Life first frightened the pants off me to facilitate its purpose.
Not that life was going well. How could it? I was living a lie and had totally lost my way. Often it was a case of sheer survival, from one moment to the next, especially in those early days. But the knowledge of who I had been, albeit buried deep, meant I had to keep on keeping on. And unlike my father, I did possess a strange, unsinkable self-belief that, despite everything, still burned within.
Operation Bootstrap. Raise myself by, or strangle myself with my own.
For now, though, I found myself locked in a vortex of anxiety that dominated everything else. Rather than whatever had caused it, the state itself became the thing, especially during those university years. I even wrote an essay about it, Stop the World, in a collection called What It Feels Like to Be Me. I appear as Stephen Vaughan, a pseudonym my dad would use when reviewing historical novels. The parallels between us, that we both had introspective, anonymous essays published as part of collections, wasn't lost on me. I even mention it in my piece. But how are they connected, and how does any of this relate to my father?
The short answer is, I'm not sure. Nor am I trying to make a case for it. Because all roads most certainly do not lead to my dad. My mother suffered from panic attacks, and there is a line of anxiety, even trauma, on that side of the family. Besides, we are all responsible for our own lives. And even if there was an evidential link with demonstrable, provable metrics, there is no question of blame. Although I often hated him, even wished him dead, my dad gave me an awful lot, and I have come to understand him, even more so through this process, and choose to interpret all his choices and behaviours through the eyeglass of compassion. Compassion for where he came from and his subjective experience.
What I'm fighting more than anything is this self-obsession, because I find my thoughts are stunted by it. It atrophies my attempts to construct character or incident. And it is too late now to understand people.
He made many messes along the way, but he did the best he could with the tools to hand. No one would choose to be the way he was. Looking back, his anger and his reactions to others was often so melodramatic, so ridiculous, as to not seem quite real. It was like he was a caricature, but he wasn't. He was just being himself.
Well, actually, you see, he doesn't come out of it badly in a way, because really what it is a nakedness. Mm. And the really bad people in this world manage to cover up and use their badness, their anger, for evil purposes. He never did that.
No,
it all just came out. It's sort of almost childish. Mm. So there is a sort of innocence there. And I think an affectionate heart, probably, underneath it all. Yeah. He was a hurt man.
I do, though, see a line between what my dad calls his private flight from growing up and my own. In a crucial sense, and whatever the reason, I couldn't imagine doing so, and in a way I didn't. A bit like him.
Let us face it, I've never really grown up. Even this attitude of, you can't trust people, it is the plaint of the adolescent.
What I do know is that I'm finding myself on the very cusp of the adult world, without the psychological wherewithal to cope, and unable to share these feelings. I was driven in on myself. Interestingly, my father alludes to his own fractured soul in a monologue to his lover, Bill, aka Doris.
Loving you is no real substitute for a broken mainspring.
My dad was certainly damaged, but in a different way, certainly in its manifestation, which was outward rather than, in my case, inward. But whatever the cause, whatever the wound, one outcome was certainly the same. We are, both late starters and late developers.
I have kept alive. I am keeping alive. That may not seem much to show for this last year. It may not seem much to show for 43 years. Believe me, it is something. Every post, a winning post.
It's New Year's Day night, 2003. I have recently experienced a particularly bad period of mental health, brought on by the death of my mother and by a job for which I am temperamentally unsuited and from which I have abruptly quit, telling the CEO that I am leaving to write a book, whilst desperately trying to hide the truth, which is that I am unable to function. A few weeks have now elapsed, and I can finally detect an improvement in my state. But I have no idea what life holds for me. Lying in bed, I tell myself to relax, that nothing will come to me if I'm tense, that I must empty my head and see what happens. Then, miraculously, something does. an idea for a book. What feels like an astonishingly good idea for a book. It comes almost fully formed. So I get up and I write down everything that I can think of around this idea, then come back to bed. I have more ideas, so I get up again, write more, then return. Yet more ideas come, but I don't want to disturb my girlfriend asleep next to me. So this time I write them down, in the dark, on paper I cannot see, hoping I'll be able to read them in the morning. I work hard at my idea, and although I abandon it halfway, and things will continue to be up and down for the next few years, this is the beginning for me of a return to normal feelings and reactions, even to moments of happiness like the ones I would experience on a Saturday when my dad was out. I guess I was finally on a road of creation, one that I had lost track of all those years ago, and one that chimed with my soul.
After the first fever of writing, the more detached approach that is likelier to yield dividends, the first being the masturbation into the old sock, or the impassioned and self-betraying ravings into the ear of the desired, the second, the campaign. We think, when we work ourselves up to the fever pitch, that we can melt our medium by our soul's heat and shape it, and that the only climate in which true consummation can be attained is that of frenzy. But we come to know, in the end, the satisfactions of gradual tactical success and the deep delights of objectives achieved by planning. After one makes an ass of oneself in love or writing, one learns that the secret is to care less and be more cool.
During the transcription process, I had regular exchanges and discussions with Emma, the transcriber. Over email, she would offer estimates as to when the next diary would be complete, and occasionally provide commentary, offering notes or observations about unusual references, or marvelling at their content. When we first sat down to discuss the work, Emma announced to me that she was autistic, and therefore, as she said, good at this kind of thing. She was better than good. She was amazing, unpicking the unpickable, but also using her own knowledge to offer comparisons and historical and literary references. One day, towards the end of the process, I received the following message from her.
Hi, Saul. Hope you're well and navigating the spring weather. This is the Tidied Up Diary 4 from 1960. Page numbers in sync with the other diaries. Your father is so interesting. Sure had his finger on history, didn't he? End of empire and end of socialism, both having to face their Waterloo. What a privilege to read the progression through the diaries. The latest like a symphony, pulling together the previous discordant confusions with sparkling naturalist observations and flashbacks. I thought you should know that on pages 43 to 44 of the attached, it seems that perhaps he killed someone. Look forward to speaking when we do. Emma.
Who are you?
Next time, the last time, on Devil in the Wilderness.
Whether he'd been driving without a license and somebody got killed in an accident.
It's that element of calculation in it that shames me.
Who are you?
And makes it murder.
Answer me!
Devil in the Wilderness was written and produced by me, Saul Wordsworth. Original music, such as this track, is also by me and is available on Spotify. Link in the show notes.
No way, Jose!
The executive producer of the series is Paul Kobrak. The voice of my father is performed by Chris Porter. Other voices in this episode are John O'Connor, Joanne Akbar, Natasha Barlow, and Sophie Herxheimer.